Oh, these five aggregates. The Buddha describes, as we've been saying, as the, we could say, magnets for clinging. And recognizing the insubstantiality, emptiness of those aggregates, as Gil pointed to yesterday with that beautiful quote. Don't think I have it exactly, but something like Avalokiteshvara, practicing deeply, realized that all five aggregates were empty and was relieved from suffering, released from suffering. So exploring the emptiness of the aggregates in that example and that quote about practicing deeply to realize the emptiness of the aggregates, that's what led to the release from the suffering, the release from the clinging. And this is repeated over and over again in the suttas, that the clinging is this, is the suffering. The clinging is the suffering. And when we can really, when that clinging is released, the suffering is released. So this points to perhaps a way to begin exploring how to release that clinging, recognize the emptiness of the aggregates. What does that mean? Neil talked about that a little bit yesterday. We might have ideas about what empty means. Lots of concepts associated with that English word empty. But it's defined. At one point, Ananda came to the Buddha and asked him, "It is said that the world is empty. In what respect is it said that the world is empty?" The Buddha replied, "Insofar as it is empty of self or anything pertaining to self. Thus it is said, Ananda, that the world is empty. And what is empty of self or anything that pertains to self? The I is empty of self or anything pertaining to self. Forms, I consciousness, I contact, are empty of self or anything pertaining to self." And this is repeated, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. The mind is empty of self or anything pertaining to self. Ideas, mind consciousness, mind contact are empty of self or anything pertaining to self. Thus, it is said that the world is empty. That's the definition of emptiness in this context. We explore One way to explore empty of self is to explore how do we self, how do we make that selfing? What is that experience of selfing? The teachings also point to the conditioned nature of experience. As a part of this constructing of the sense of self, the teaching on dependent origination, which we have not gone into depth on, just mentioned a couple of times. It's a description of starting from ignorance, how suffering comes to be. There's 12 links in this cycle of dependent origination, starting from ignorance and going through consciousness, mental consciousness, and the nama rupa, the other aggregates are part of this chain of dependent origination. In this link from there, we have contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, aging and death, and the entire mass of suffering. So this description of conditions with contact as condition, feeling comes to be with feeling as condition, craving comes to be with craving as condition, clinging comes to be with clinging as condition, becoming comes to be. With becoming as condition, birth, with birth as condition, aging and death, and the entire mass of suffering. And so this description of how suffering comes to be, this conditioned arising of suffering, also points to the conditioned arising of the sense of self, the term becoming can be understood as a kind of a formation of identity. And so seeing the conditioned nature of our experience, which is what we've been pointing to in particular with mental formations, how mental formations construct the rest of the aggregates. Seeing that conditioned nature helps the mind to understand this not a self in here doing this process, just the process is unfolding. So we can start to experience the processes at work and have the felt understanding seeing that emptiness, the emptiness of self and what belongs to self. Yesterday, Gil mentioned these similes that connect to the aggregates. And these similes are pointing to the empty nature of the aggregates. Five similes, one for each of the aggregates. The body is like a lump of foam, feeling an airy bubble. Perception is like a mirage. Mental formations like a banana tree. And in this Sutta, where he talks about these similes, he uses some words. He says, since we're doing today, our topic is mental formations, so we'll explore this through the mental formations simile. So it says, just as someone wanting to find heartwood would go into, seeking heartwood would go into a forest and find this solid looking tree and cut it down. And if they've cut down this banana tree, then when they take it back to their home, they'll see it just unrolls. The coil unrolls, all of those leaves, they just unroll. And there's nothing, the sutta says, there's no softwood, much less hardwood. Just a pile of leaves sitting in front of you after you have unrolled this coil. And he says, someone with good sight would inspect this and realize that it is hollow, void, insubstantial, pointing to the emptiness of heartwood of the banana tree. That it doesn't, it's not what it seems to be. Those banana trees, I spent some time in the Peace Corps in the South Pacific, and those banana trees look pretty solid. Their trunks are pretty hefty, 6 or so inches around. They're pretty hard. You have to take a hatchet to whack it down. So it seems so substantial. And then he goes on to say in the sutta, just as someone who would carefully inspect mental formations, they would see it to be hollow, insubstantial, void. Like a banana tree, these mental formations. So kind of pointing to a simile for mental formations being like a banana tree, this layered nature. Mental formations laying one on top of another, the constructing nature of mental formations to construct the aggregates, all just laid on top of each other, creating this sense of solidity, of substantiality. So some of the people who talk about the sutta point out that each of these similes kind of points to, in a way, the way in which we get confused by the aggregate, to believe its substantiality, its solidity. So with that banana tree, it seems so solid because it's all layered. Every one of those leaves is layered on top of the other. And they're kind of stiff, those banana leaves. The sheaf of those banana leaves, they're kind of thick. And so the sense of the piling on top of one piled on top of another creates the illusion of something solid. So this is kind of how our mental formations work. We have this sense sometimes of just a reminder of mental formations are these many mental activities in the mind that have a kind of propulsion to them. There's an intention connected with them, a volition connected with them. So this includes all of what we would think of as our kind of emotional life. It includes thoughts. Gil was speaking of it a lot, this area, as generative thinking. And yet mental formations also includes emotions like anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, wanting, pride, arrogance. A lot of the emotional kind of realm that we live in, reactive emotions. And we can see the shaping quality of these reactive emotions too. Like Gil was talking about the generative quality of thought. These emotions also, when anger arises, it shapes our experience. If anger's arising, it will create kind of pressure and heat in the body, unpleasantness probably in the body. It will tend to make us perceive things from that perspective of anger. It will generate more anger and tend to make us become aware of things that confirm that perspective of anger, to become conscious of things that confirm that perspective of anger. So these emotional states also generate the other aggregates. And these emotions also, we have the sense, I mean, in talking to many, many people about what they experience, so often these emotions get layered. It's not just like a simple anger is arising. There's anger and frustration and confusion and wanting to be safe and wanting to get back at what somebody else has done. There's layers and layers and layers of emotions, creating that kind of sense of solidity. This is one of the ways that we can identify. We identify, we take it to be me. It's so solid. It seems so solid. It's not just poof, anger arising. It's a history too of previous anger and, you know, kind of the history of things from the past coming in, all of those mental formations, those ideas coming in. But there's a sense of that solidity. And we can begin to be curious about the layers, to be aware of the layers. So with reactive emotions, as we've been talking about, and you know, many of you have been describing seeing the generative nature of mental formations, seeing how a thought in the mind will shape the next thing that happens, and beginning to see that that's a process, not something I'm doing. You know, if I had charge of this mind, I probably would say, no, don't do that. But we can have the intention, all of what we're doing here is shaping conditions. You're sitting in this hall and listening to talks about being mindful of mental formations. That creates the conditions that there might be some interest in being mindful of mental formations, and mindfulness arises sometimes, and oh, there's something to be seen, and what's here? And we're shaping the conditions. The whole context of what we're doing is shaping conditions in a way, using a different kind of mental formation, a wholesome mental formation, also a mental formation. Mindfulness is a mental formation. Wisdom is a mental formation. Love, compassion are mental formations. These also shape experience. And so we can bring mindfulness and wisdom to the reactive mental formations. And that process, it's like that exploration. What does it mean to be mindful of anger and frustration and confusion and the coil? Partly what we can do here is let the mindfulness, the awareness, the curiosity of what is this banana tree, and let the mindfulness and wisdom do the unrolling of the coil, reveal the empty nature, of this layers upon layers of reactivity. And seeing the empty nature, seeing the not self nature, seeing that this just happens, that a pattern of reactivity arises in dependence on seeing a sight and hearing a sound and having that trigger or kind of bring along a memory from the past. So that's a conditioned arising. The memory arises based on the sight or sound. And then that memory brings kind of conditions or brings in a whole host of mental formations, of layers of mental formation, constructing in the moment more emotions, more potentially reactivity. We see this process happening, and we see with mindfulness, we can see this is just the banana leaves. These are just the banana coil, just unrolling that coil of banana leaves. There's another mental formation that seems fairly potent in the creation of clinging, in the construction of clinging, and in terms of undoing the clinging, shifting from clinging to non-clinging, seeing the emptiness. It's useful to understand how these processes work a little bit so they can be seen. And then it is the seeing of them that helps the mind to let go, helps the mind to understand the futility of the clinging. So the texts point to a process is wound up with delusion, kind of embedded or woven together with delusion, that's connected to perception, it's connected to the recognizing process. It's a mental formation that tends to come up with perception, tends to happen with perception. And then that mental formation shapes how the aggregates are conditioned. So this is a fairly familiar sutta to some of you. Perhaps this is called the Honeyball Sutta. And the mental formation that is pointed to as a key, as a kind of a linchpin in the process of how suffering comes into being for us, the term in the Pali is called papancha. So here's a description of how papancha arises. It goes through, the sutta goes through the all six sense bases in this, and I'll just read it with respect to the eye and forms and sight. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. So right there, we have the aggregates coming together. The eye informs is the rupa, eye consciousness, the consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. Contact is actually understood as a mental formation. So right there, we've got the eye and forms, eye consciousness and contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. All five aggregates right there in this process described. So we have a sight. We see something. Right there, we've got the eye forms, eye consciousness and contact. There's something that's seen, the appearance. Appearance comes into being with the form and the knowing of that form. We see a flower in the garden. With that contact, there is feeling, a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality. We see the flower, maybe a pleasant feeling, and the perceiving of that as a flower, maybe the kind of flower. Oh, that's a rose, something like that. So that's the kind of the experience of how our sense perception process of recognizing all of that kind of works. From there, it goes on. What one perceives, that one thinks about. So we start thinking about the rose. What kind of rose is it? Where can I get a rose like that? Maybe I should plant one like that in my garden. Now this is beginning to tip to the next piece, which is what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. And that's the word, sometimes this is with the translation here, that one mentally proliferates is translating this word papancha. That one papanchizes. That one papanchas about. So this way of understanding papancha is very similar to what Gil described in terms of generative thinking. We think about something and then it just starts to like have its own momentum. It generates itself. It tumbles on. And I've heard so many of you describe seeing this, you know, witnessing this process happening in the mind. Again, as empty of self, it is just a process. It's like, I don't decide to start thinking about the kind of rose it is and where I could plant it in the garden. It just happens. So empty of self and what belongs to self. And yet, this process of papancha begins to fool us. It takes us out of recognizing that it's a process and into something believing about, I need to think about this, or this is important to figure out where I would plant this in my garden. So this process of papancha kind of hijacks our perceptual system, our perceptual experience. The sutta goes on. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset one with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Now, that sentence sounds a little complicated, but basically, it means that because of that papancha, because of those proliferation of thoughts and ideas, that begins to influence, right, the things that we have thought about in the past begin to come into the present. What we're thinking about in the present has a tumbling on into the future. And we are shaped by, this is the kind of the shaping process of these aggregates, where, like, for instance, anger shapes our bodies, our minds. At one point I was doing walking meditation in the hall in IMS, the walking hall in IMS. And I knew I had aversion. You know, I was aware that I was experiencing aversion. And so I was doing the walking back and forth, just noticing, experiencing, knowing that aversion, feeling the tension of it. So feeling all of what we've just talked about. And then I turned around at one point at the end of my path, and I saw somebody else's shoes at the end of my path. And the mind just exploded in like anger and hatred and just like, who put those shoes there and who do they think they are anyway? That experience of the reaction to seeing those shoes, you know, if I'd been doing walking meditation and my experience had been metta, not anger, you know, and I turned around and saw those shoes, it might have been, oh, somebody's shoes are there. Oh, I hope they're happy. But the mind had been shaped by anger. And so seeing the shoes, that experience, that simple, neutral experience of seeing shoes was completely swamped and influenced by that state of the mind. And I saw that. But this is how Bhapancha works. It tumbles us forward, that generative thinking. There's another understanding of Bhapancha. The term translated here is mental proliferation. Some translators have looked at the use of the word and other places it's used in the suttas, and there's some other places that the word is referred to. And in one place, the kind of falling away of Bhapancha, the release of Bhapancha, is described as being very close, if not identical to, freedom. So, freedom, the ending of greed, aversion, delusion, is a lot more than just a quiet mind. We can have a mind that has the thinking has subsided and still have a lot of generation going on. And so some scholars have looked at what this might mean, what this Bhapancha might mean. There's a couple different translations for this term. Objectification is one I particularly like. Reification. So possibly what some scholars point to as this word meaning is the process by which we recognize something. So Bhapancha springs off of perception in the sutta. What one perceives, that one thinks about, what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates, that one Bhapanchas about. Perhaps this Bhapancha is the process by which we take our perceptions, what we're perceiving, what we're recognizing, to be reality, to be real, to be a thing, objectification. When we look at our experience moment after moment, we see that it's just a sight arising as a construction of the mind. It's an arising and passing phenomenon. It's not a thing. It is simply a phenomenon, a kind of a passing phenomenon in the mind. And yet when we are experiencing the world through our perceptions and our knowing, we tend to be navigating the world, taking what we are experiencing as being the truth of the experience. We don't just see it as something arising in our mind. I think I said the other day, you know, talking about perception, that I think perception does a pretty good job of reflecting what's out there. But it is just a reflection. It is not the thing. What we are experiencing is not the actual thing out there. It is our idea of the thing, the concept of the thing. So this may be what Papancha refers to, that tendency to believe our concepts to be reality, to be something true, to be something that it is not. One of the other similes kind of points to this around perception. The simile for perception that Gil mentioned yesterday is the simile of a mirage. And the way a mirage works actually is it's kind of interesting. You know, the classic mirage of seeing water in a desert. What's going on there is that, you know, the heat is rising from the desert. It's creating this kind of visual field of a refractive space. And what it is doing there, it's like it's created almost a mirror on the surface of the desert. And what it is doing, it's reflecting the sky. That kind of the heat waves are reflecting the sky. And so it's reflecting something that's there, but it is being misunderstood as something that it's not. So we're taking it to be something that it's not, but it is a reflection of something that's there. It's not that it's nothing. It's not a complete imagination, but it is a misunderstanding of what has been recognized. The misunderstanding. So this process of papancha, I'm actually going to read this section using objectification as the word for papancha instead of mentally proliferates. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one objectifies. With objectification as the source, perceptions and notions born of objectification beset one with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So this process is a process of objectifying, of essentially taking what we are experiencing, not to just simply be processes of body and mind, but to be reality, to be what's out there. That's a really deep tendency of human beings. It's just, we're not taught to do anything else. And it kind of is part, almost part of our sensory apparatus in a way to kind of take that information as being the truth. So it runs, this tendency runs really deep, this believing what we are experiencing to be the reality. Not seeing them as processes, not seeing them as constructs of the mind. So this process of objectification, process of, that's that thing, turning something into a thing, essentially. It's the mind making a thing out of experience, as opposed to understanding it as just a mental processes at work. What seems to happen as the mind does that, when it objectifies something, creating an object out of something, simultaneously it creates a subject, someone who is experiencing that. And so this process of papancha not only creates this sense of stuff, but also creates a me experiencing that stuff. the more we can watch these processes at work, these processes of the aggregates at work, we can begin to see that we do tend to believe something's out there. We are creating this sense of solidity of thingness. We're probably not going to be able to stop doing that. But recognizing that it's happening is a kind of a step to beginning to support the mind to let go. Away, there's I think this really, to me, this process of objectification, it ties into views and beliefs, the believing that there's something out there. Beliefs are taken to be some truth as opposed to a process of mind believing something. And so this may be a way to be curious about this process of papancha. There's a couple of ways I've explored this. One is just to kind of look at, what am I taking to be solid? What am I taking to be substantial? And then get curious, you know, is it really solid? Is it really substantial? Sure feels like it. But then sometime later, you know, something like a mental formation, you know, for myself, this process of self-hatred was so solid, so much just it seems to be a part of who I was. And yet, you know, so seeing that, yep, that's me. Yep, it's there. It's always there. It feels like it's always there. If it's not there, it's like all I have to do is think about it and it's there. But feels so solid. And yet to begin to be curious, is it always there? That thing that seems so solid, so stable. Notice when it's not there. That begins to poke holes in the belief of the solidity, kind of the idea that it is always there. And to my surprise, there were definitely times, you know, doing this around self-hate, just like, oh yeah, wow, it's not there right now. 2 minutes later, it was back, but it wasn't there in that moment. Just beginning to poke holes in the idea that it is a thing that is there, solid, stable, me, who I am. You know, if it's not always there, it can't be who I am. Now, that's one way of exploring this looking at what I'm taking to be solid, okay, what I'm taking to be substantial. And just curiosity, is it always there? Sometimes we might notice, you know, wow, it seems like it's always there while I'm looking at it, but then a day later, wow, it's not here today. It's not here right now. I didn't see it go away, but it's not here right now. So this can be a way to begin to poke holes in the beliefs around the solidity, beliefs around the substantiality. It is just a belief. The other way is to look at beliefs, be curious about what's being believed. Another way of exploring what's going on in our experience. Often what we believe, or, you know, there's so often things underneath the surface that we are just taking to be true. And because we're just taking them to be true, like the thingness of experience, we don't question it. We don't see that it's based on belief. We just think it's like some base level of truth. And so I've seen in my own practice at times, especially around mental formations, the layers and layers of mental formations, being with the experience of that, it's sometimes really helpful to, when you can really be present with the experience, just drop in the question, and what's being believed here? What's being believed in connection with this experience? It may be that there'll be something, I mean, you may or may not see a belief there, but sometimes there can be something that kind of shows up. An idea, a belief. And it's useful, I found another piece of this exploration around belief I found useful is to be curious about how much I'm believing it. So for instance, around the self-hatred, there were a lot of beliefs. You know, I'm a failure. I can't do things right. And those were just kind of the base level belief of who I was. It wasn't like, you know, I thought, that piece didn't necessarily feel like aversion. It just felt like fact. I'm a failure. And so sometimes seeing those beliefs, I could see when they were revealed, when they were seen as beliefs. Just that piece can be powerful because when something is exposed as a belief that we had taken to be true, so I'm a failure. It's like, you know, I don't even believe that right now. But there was some part of me that believed it. So there can be a kind of a curiosity about how much do I believe that right now? How much is that belief shaping the mind? Sometimes it's like, yeah, I'm really on board with that one. That feels pretty true to me right now. Or sometimes it's, yeah, I don't actually believe that right now, but I can't like stop believing it. And consciously, I don't believe it, but some underlying piece believes it. So in this practice around looking at beliefs, I often say to people, when a belief is exposed, you do not have to try to stop believing it. Like, for instance, that I'm a failure, you know, belief. Because some part of the system was believing it, it wouldn't have actually been so helpful to tell myself, oh, no, you're not a failure. You know, it's like that part of the mind that believes that is going to say, yeah, you're just telling me stories. You know, you're just lying to me here. So what I found useful is just to acknowledge, yes, that is being believed right now. That is being believed right now. And how much do I believe it? Sometimes stronger, sometimes weaker. Just the seeing of it, as we've been saying, just the seeing. This believing is a form of clinging. Just the seeing of it changes the equation, helps the mind to let it go. Another piece around mental formations and release of clinging. There's a teaching in the suttas that points to essentially use mental formations, not just the process of observing mental formations for them to fall away, you know, seeing the patterns and habits and mindfulness allowing them to fall away, but using mental formations, wholesome mental formations, to help release less wholesome mental formations. Essentially using the constructing nature of mental formations to our advantage. This is essentially what we're doing here. I said that at the beginning, this whole process of sitting in this retreat, hearing the descriptions of practice, hearing what's possible, your own exposure to practice in the past, your own understanding of the value of it, all of that contributes to the cultivation of these wholesome qualities of mindfulness, of kindness, of wisdom, of generosity, of patience, of concentration, all of these wholesome qualities, of joy, of letting go, wisdom. So the teaching has this kind of, I think of it kind of as a stair step kind of process around mental formations. And the phrase is, by relying on this, abandon that. When there are unwholesome mental states arising, by relying on wholesome mental states, we can let go of unwholesome mental states. So this is a way that we facilitate the processes themselves, facilitate the letting go, the release from clinging. By relying on this, abandon that. So the way this kind of looks sometimes is, you know, you might be noticing a whole bunch of reactivity. This is where our practice starts often. We notice a whole bunch of reactivity and we learn to practice mindfulness with some kind attention and some patience. So we bring some wholesome qualities to bear on the challenge. And that creates the conditions for the weakening of those unwholesome states. By relying on the mindfulness, the wisdom, the patience, these reactive patterns weaken. By relying on this, abandon that. So there's a weakening of the reactivity. The suffering gets less. Maybe it even falls away. And then we have these wholesome qualities that have been being cultivated. And we might start to see, you know, while there was the reactive habits and patterns operating, you know, the suffering of those reactive habits and patterns is pretty strong. And so we might be in the exploration of that, you know, a little bit of clinging to or leaning into the mindfulness or holding on to or doing the practice. So there might be a little bit of clinging with those wholesome qualities. Maybe, maybe not always, but maybe there is a little bit of clinging there. But still, the clinging of that to that wholesome state is so much less suffering than the suffering of those unwholesome states that it's like, it's not as strong, it's not as relevant in a way. But as soon as the suffering of the unwholesome state begins to fall away, then we might begin to experience the tension of the holding on to the identification of being the meditator, for instance, as one of the patterns that I can do this practice. I can really investigate so clearly. I can look at something and it will go away. And then we start feeling the suffering of that clinging to those wholesome states. And then the Buddha points to some kind of subtler wholesome states that support us to let go of that clinging. By relying on this, abandon that. By relying on this, abandon that. In that sutta, the last thing pointed to in the relying on this, abandon that, is a word, a Pali word, atamayata, which means something like non-fashioning, non-constructing. So it's gone through a whole bunch of different steps, you know, by relying on the joy of renunciation, one can abandon the clinging to the joy of the sense pleasure. By relying on the equanimity around sense experience, one can abandon the clinging to the joy. By relying on non-fashioning, one can abandon the clinging to equanimity. This is the final piece, the non-constructing. And for mental formations, you know, the constructing nature of mental formations, I don't know. I'm curious. Atamayata, it's non-fashioning. Does that mean it's not a mental formation? I don't know. But relying on not fashioning. The word non-fashioning, kind of in contrast to its flip word of tamayata, of constructing or fashioning. The word fashioning means something like made of that, like the the example, some of the example is like when you reach out to grasp something like this, you grasp a glass or a cup or a bottle or something, the hand takes the shape of the bottle in order to grasp it. And it's like that taking shape, the mind taking the shape of the thing. The making of thing and the mind taking that shape of the making of thing. And it is said that the mind of the Buddha is not that. Not of that, not in that. Be feeling into that, the not picking up, the not engaging, the non-fashioning. Relying on this, abandon that. So this process of letting go of clinging, it's a process. We're not going to be able to non-fashion in an instant. But the understanding of that's where it's headed. Not picking up. When we can see the picking up and feel what happens with the picking up. Feel the constriction, feel the suffering, and then the wisdom begins to figure out how to let go of the clinging.